You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden Tokawingawa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ngā Pare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranusha. E whā akene coming up on the show for City Councilling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about Community Committee grants for 2026 and a proposal from Main Freight to open bus lanes to trucks. I also spoke to Associate Professor Tayans Henning of the University of Auckland's Faculty of Engineering about the challenges for New Zealand's infrastructure in the face of increasing extreme weather events. Pranusha, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halper about leadership pressure on the government, inflation, and the response to recent flooding. I spoke to Emeritus Professor Tim Hazeldine about New Zealand First's proposal to break up the supermarket duopoly, and I spoke with Dr. Christopher Cornwall about the environmental impacts of the sewage discharge following the flooding in Wellington.
Hei aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka au e wariwari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, e pakeheri rukiruki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM, erekati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts, rima toru iwa rima 5395, or give us a call in studio, toru kore iwa toru waru fitu iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The Prime Minister has survived the recent confidence vote, but questions still remain about the stability of Christopher Luxton's leadership and what that means for the government going forward. At the same time, inflation has come in higher than expected, rising 3.1% annually and 0.9% in the March quarter, adding to ongoing concerns about the cost of living. And in Wellington, severe flash flooding has once again raised questions about whether our cities are prepared for the increasing extreme weather. For our weekly catch-up with Shannon, with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halper about all these issues.
The Prime Minister has just survived a confidence vote, but there's clearly still pressure around his leadership. What do you make of where things stand for the government right now?
Certainly it's been a disrupted week, but in my view this is very much a classic national. We've seen things fall apart both within the National Party and with coalition partners. To an extent, they're eating each other alive, and that's what we've seen from the National Party in the past. And this is why we've called them the coalition of chaos from the start of this term.
The confidence vote seems to have been driven by poor polling, economic frustration, and growing unease within National's own caucus. What do you think this result actually means?
Well, New Zealanders have become increasingly frustrated by the lack of leadership that Prime Minister Luxton has demonstrated, the promise of cost of living respite, which has never been delivered on. And so New Zealanders really have had enough, and that's the feedback I suspect that backbench MPs have been getting from their constituents and communities. And they haven't been able to see any change or get any alternative outcome from the leadership within the government. So, that's when you see disgruntled members start to take action. That's where the uncertainty has come from, and we've seen that play out. What's important here, though, is that as opposition, we stay focused on the issues that are important to New Zealanders. That's jobs, health, homes, and actually getting some real action on the cost of living.
Do you think this is something that's just internal political noise, or is it actually going to start affecting how the government governs and makes decisions?
Well, New Zealanders are feeling uncertain at the moment due to global factors, the fuel crisis, the cost of living challenges, and that's not what we've seen this government focused on. Even this week, we've seen, you know, a focus on the Treaty of Waitangi once again. These are not, that's not something that New Zealanders want to see government focused on. They want to know that they're going to be able to get by, that they're going to be able to put food on the table, that the government has a good plan around the fuel crisis. But actually, that's not what the government is delivering on. And I think people are really starting to speak up on that, to feel the pressure on that. And that's what they're telling government MPs as well.
We've also seen fresh reporting around inflation pressures, with the Wall Street Journal noting New Zealand's inflation rising 3.1% annually and 0.9% in the March quarter. There are concerns that these pressures could stick around, especially with the rising energy and fuel costs. What's your view on how the government is handling those pressures at the moment?
Well, National promised to fix the cost of living, but they've made it worse. It was problematic before the fuel crisis. And what we've seen is a very light plan on how the government intends to address the factors that are in front of us, and that includes inflation. People know how much inflation can affect their weekly budgets, their ability to get by, and the ability to look after their families. So there is significant concern there.
Do you think New Zealanders are already feeling the brunt of the impact of those rising costs, or is there still more to come?
Well, data shows that prices were already rising even before the conflict in the Middle East. And this was, you know, as we've said before, this was a direct result of the government's choices since they came into office.
With fuel prices expected to push inflation higher again next quarter, do you think the government is fully prepared for that?
No, we don't. The government has come up with a very light plan on how New Zealand is going to respond to the fuel crisis, despite multiple questions from journalists, from opposition in Parliament. We haven't seen the leadership or the detail come through from the Prime Minister or from Nicola Willis. They can't just continue to blame global factors for their failures. Households and businesses are having a much harder time dealing with the rising fuel costs now, because this government has failed to get a grip on the rising cost of living right from the start. They promised change. They haven't been able to achieve that.
What would Labor be doing differently right now to ease that pressure?
Well, Labor would be demonstrating some leadership, as we did throughout the pandemic period. We came up with a very detailed plan on how we were going to respond both to the health component of the pandemic, but also the economic component that comes through. We made sure that we looked after lives and livelihoods, that people were able to keep their jobs. That's not what this government has done. We've seen the highest unemployment that New Zealand has seen in decades.
And moving on to the flash flooding in Wellington, we've seen a state of emergency declared after intense localised rainfall causing major disruption across the city. How would you assess the response so far?
Well, firstly, I just want to acknowledge the passing of Philip Sutton and mihi to his whānau. It's very sad when we lose people in such weather events like this. And acknowledge our frontline workers that have been here in Wellington doing the work that's required to keep everyone safe. It's important that in severe weather events, that are in fact becoming far more frequent, that we take urgent and meaningful action to address this.
You touched a little bit last week on Cyclone Vaianu. Do you think this event has exposed any further gaps on how prepared our cities are for this kind of extreme weather?
I think what's real and what the government needs to understand is that these events keep happening. The government has failed to act or take climate change seriously. I think New Zealanders are really opening their eyes and are worried about that. We saw this when they cancelled the National Resilience Fund and they cut back on flood resilience funding. So the government really needs to take proper action. They need to invest in such solutions and ensure that all New Zealanders are kept safe. Over time, you start to erode the protections that are in place in that area, and that will impact us economically.
And what would Labor's response look like?
Well, Labor's demonstrated in the past that they have invested in climate change, that we've taken it seriously, we've signed up to the Paris commitment, and we demonstrated the leadership that New Zealand needed for both a short and long-term response to addressing these issues. We'll continue to do that when we win government in November. But the reality is these weather events are happening here and now. We need a government that is responsive, that is able to invest in them. And our role is to keep the pressure on the government and make sure that they're taking the action that they need to.
That was Shannon Halbert about leadership pressure on the government, inflation and the response to recent flooding.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council's Community Committee has allocated $300,000 across 11 community-led organisations as part of the Thriving Communities Grant. Council has also allocated $286,000 to arts and culture projects, ranging from dance, poetry, performance, music and storytelling. And logistics and transport company Main Freight has approached Auckland Transport, suggesting that bus lanes be opened to trucks and courier vehicles. I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about both of these topics. I started by asking if he could explain the Thriving Communities Grant and the process of selecting organisations for it.
Yeah, so it's a contestable grant. So, organisations apply and they go through a process with staff. That gets voted on and then the money's allocated. So, this is a fantastic initiative. We're talking about $300,000 going to 11 organisations that provide really critical work in the community around social well-being, education and housing support. So just for an example, for the listeners, some of the money goes to Diabetes Foundation to maximise the benefits of community gardens. Another one is the Massey Community Trust, so something close to the heart of West Aucklanders, and they provide a project that gives immediate youth-centred accommodation for people that need it through trained and vetted homes. So, yeah, direct impacts on our housing crisis. Those are some examples there. It's a fantastic initiative.
And why do you think it's important for council to fund these kinds of community organisations?
Well, council has a mandate to build the communities that they represent, so and make sure they thrive, right? So it's not simply a matter, in my opinion, of rates, roads and rubbish in the old sort of traditional way, but taking care of our housing and our economic development and making sure that every Aucklander has the best life they can and they can thrive. That's something that I think most people want their representatives to work on, because we all want to live in a city that we can grow and we can enjoy. So, and that starts with taking care of people that are really struggling. I think that's an important part of council's work.
There's also been a recent grant round for arts and culture funding. How were these projects selected?
Yeah, it's the same process that I've sort of just described. It's a contestable process where people make applications or organisations make applications, and then that goes through staff and they apply their kind of expert lens to it, and then grants are allocated and voted on through council. And yeah, that's another example of, we need to live in a city that we can enjoy and that will attract talent and all the rest of it. And so that relies upon our arts and culture sector thriving as best as we can as well.
I think arts and culture funding from council may be more contestable or seen as less important in the minds of some people. So can you talk through more of the rationale of council investing in arts and cultures, including what kind of benefits that could bring to the city?
Yeah, absolutely. So, investing in arts and culture is a way of telling sort of our stories as Aucklanders. But also there's a clear, and enjoying the city, right? That's its own public good as well. But there's also an economic development angle to this, and we want to create a city that people will see their future in, that they will stay and they'll grow their families and will attract more talent to the city as well. And so that relies upon our city being enjoyable, being a fun place to live in. And so there's all that and a bunch of other reasons as well. And the tragedy of this is arts and culture, and I'd put environment into that category as well. It's seen as kind of first on the chopping block and discretionary when times are tough, when actually I think it's more important than ever that people can enjoy their city, especially in tough times, not in spite of it.
And I want to change tack now and ask about something that Main Freight has proposed, which is letting trucks use bus lanes to help these companies save on diesel costs. Is this something council would consider?
Yeah, look, I'm not a fan personally, and I heard the mayor as well make some really good points about this. Because, you know, here's the thing, bus lanes are already crowded and they're already an issue. The trucks on that particular part of the road would only make that problem worse. I understand where Main Freight are coming from, but you know, I think the real long-term solution here is to encourage more and more goods to be used on rail, not just on road, that's separated from general traffic, and it really helps in a bunch of ways, right? So yeah, and the other thing was getting trucks to operate at night, so there's no congestion, it's cost-effective, and there's impacts on less fuel use as well. Those are solutions that I think we should be looking towards. Utilising the bus lanes will only impact people's daily commute in a really negative way. This is the time when we need to encourage people onto public transport as best as we can, and so I don't want to take any backward steps in that goal.
In general, has council discussed any measures to support Auckland businesses struggling with the very current issue of rising diesel costs?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. Look, first and foremost, we do need some central government guidance, in my opinion, and a lot of other jurisdictions across the world, and especially in Australia, we're seeing central government and state governments step up. They're the ones with the big balance sheets and the big levers. We can kind of do all we can, but really that's where the big difference can be made, in my opinion, which doesn't mean we shirk any responsibility for leadership. And in fact, I think we should be trying to do what we can and advocate all we can for, attempts to address the fuel crisis. My personal view is that we've got to be focused, laser focused on public transport use. Trying to get as many people to use the system that we have in Auckland is actually fantastic. And look at what the barriers are. Is it too expensive? Does it reach your destination? Does it come to your house? Or sort of your neighbourhood, rather? Those are the things that we need to be laser focused on. And I think over the coming months, we need to discuss it as a council. But that's just my view.
And I want to really quickly ask, because I saw on social media this week that you were interviewed by Guy Williams about how your last name is Henderson and you represent Henderson. What's it like having the last name of the area you represent?
It's a very common joke. Every couple of days, someone points out that my last name is Henderson and I represent Henderson. But I don't know. Maybe it's a bit of a secret to my electoral success over time. Who knows?
Does it help that you're driving around Henderson with Henderson on your car?
Yes, but to be honest, I don't do a lot of driving these days. I mainly use the bus, which is a fantastic thing, I think. But yeah, it does help a little bit, I suppose.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on Community Committee grants for 2026 and a proposal from Main Freight to open bus lanes to trucks.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Armageddon. It's the most exciting gaming and pop culture event of the year. And if you are a wielder of the all-powerful B card, then you could win tickets. So stay tuned to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Armageddon, Anzac Long Weekend, April 25th till the 27th at the Auckland Showgrounds. Get your tickets now at iticket.co.nz or on the door.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B-card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums and more.
All right, you four Muppets, listen up. I finally pinpointed 95BFM's weak spot, Friday night, 7 till 9pm. The staff have all gone to watch Rick Breeze play water polo, so that's when we're going to strike. Phil, you're cracking the safe. Renee, you're disabling the alarm. Pat Fife, you load this BFM CD library into this sack. And Professor, you're driving the getaway van. Cushdie. Ha ha ha, they're never going to see this coming.
Gang of Four, every Friday night from 7 till 9pm, with a revolving cast of bona fide BFM legends, Renee, Pat, Phil and the Professor are putting the B into TBIF. Gang of Four, thanks to Verona, the heart of Karangahape Road.
Hey, Captain, do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months, since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that. I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim. Is that my name? Captain?
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim.
I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim. Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity and soul to your Friday afternoons. Groove 1 till 2pm every Friday right here on 95BFM.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
New Zealand First is proposing to break up one of the country's biggest supermarket players, Foodstuffs, into two competing nationwide cooperatives. The move is being pitched as a way to increase competition in a sector long criticized for high prices and limited choice. To unpack what that could mean in practice, I spoke with Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Auckland, Tim Hazeldine.
So New Zealand First is proposing to break up Foodstuffs into two nationwide cooperatives, essentially creating more direct competition within the supermarket sector. At a broad level, how significant is that proposal from your perspective?
I think it's a great idea. I think we do need more competition. I don't think we can expect some whole new firm like Aldi, the German grocer, to come into our market because we're not really big enough. So I think we've got to work with the firms we've got. And New Zealand First has said, well, one of those is Foodstuffs, and Foodstuffs is, as you say, two brands, Pack and Save, well, three really, Pack and Save, the main supermarkets and the Four Square supermarkets, and so split them up. Sounds like a good idea.
You've said breaking it up by brand might be a simpler approach rather than splitting it through the North and South Island operations. Can you explain what makes this model more workable?
Well, if you've got, it's tempting to say, well, we actually have three competitors now. We've got Progressive, or Australian Woolworths, and we've got Foodstuffs North Island and Foodstuffs South Island. And they actually do operate independently on some things like sourcing their supplies from manufacturers. So it wouldn't, you could say, well, maybe they should sort of swap some stores so that instead of being Foodstuffs North Island will be Foodstuffs Alpha, and Foodstuffs South Island will be Foodstuffs A or whatever, and they should swap some stores around so they have a presence in both islands. But that's pretty complicated. what stores would they swap and who would be in charge of doing that? So the idea that you just say, well, you've already done the job for us. You've created these major distinct grocery brands, Pack and Save, the big bulk stuff, and then the regular supermarkets, and perhaps Four Square for the other side of the market. So just work with those and break them up and make them compete with each other.
Do you think this would increase competition in a more meaningful way?
Yeah, I think it would. Three competitors is a lot more than two competitors. It's 50% more. So it's not guaranteed, but it would. Look, if it didn't work, we could always tell them to go back to their old ways. It'd be good to try it.
A lot of debate around the supermarkets comes back to pricing. Do you think a move like this would realistically lead to lower prices for consumers?
That's really the main reason to recommend it, is that the Commerce Commission and their report on the grocery supermarkets a couple of years ago decided, yes, they were overcharging, that there was monopoly profits in there that were increasing the cost of groceries to our households. So there's something to be, if they're right, and that hasn't really been successfully challenged by the supermarkets. They don't like it, but they haven't been able to overturn it, that decision or that finding. Then there is the possibility out there that more competition could lower the cost of groceries.
You've also raised the issue of access to the shelf. What does that mean in practice for suppliers and smaller brands trying to get into supermarkets?
Yeah, that's something we don't hear a lot about, but I've talked to people who are suppliers of smaller branded products, perhaps brands you haven't always heard of, although they're on the shelves. And they say that the supermarkets are also competing with their suppliers through their own private label products like PAMs that New World has. So they've got a sort of a conflict there. Supermarkets make quite a lot of money out of their private label products because they get to keep profit margin on the product. And so if you were trying to you're a small manufacturer of, say, frozen peas, not that that's a big thing anymore, but trying to get it on the shelves, And they say, well, you can, or they might say, no, we won't stock it because we've got plenty of brands already, including a PAMS, you know, a house brand. Or they might say, well, okay, we'll give you a go, but you mustn't undercut our private label brand because that's supposed to be our, you know, our price leader. If they did do that, that would actually be illegal. So I'm not claiming that they do. I don't have evidence on that. But it would certainly be worth looking into.
And finally, when you look at the supermarket landscape in New Zealand, do you think we're any closer to solving the duopoly issue, or are we still a long way off?
Well, we're just not doing anything. There's nothing happening. The New Zealand First, I think the only political party, it's the first one to actually come out and say, we think this is on our election manifesto for this year's election. If we were in government, we would do something about it. So I just hope that the two major parties, both of them preferably, say, oh, we'll do that too. But I haven't, so we'll just have to wait and see when they come up with their election manifestos.
That was Emeritus Professor Tim Hazeldine about New Zealand First proposal to break up the supermarket duopoly.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
New Zealand cities are having to make new tough decisions about infrastructure as extreme weather intensifies. I spoke to Professor Tayans Henning at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Engineering about New Zealand's infrastructure challenges and what the potential solutions are. I started by asking about the key challenges for New Zealand infrastructure and how they connect to ongoing discussions on climate resilience.
Thank you. That's a very good question. I just want to make it clear that in New Zealand we have to refer to natural hazards, not just climate hazards, because obviously our seismic part of the equation is also a significant concern to us. So the challenges is, first of all, I'm not going to go into the climate change debate, because I don't think that's a helpful discussion. But what we are seeing is that these natural hazards are increasing in number, so they're happening more frequently. And we're also seeing that sometimes the intensity or the significance of these storm events are also increasing. So we're starting to see damages and disasters that we haven't noticed before. So we are living in a changing environment. And then, of course, the biggest challenge is financing. So money in the end of the day is our biggest challenge because, A, we don't have enough money to just look after our infrastructure as it is. And then B, we then on top of that also got to make provision to make it more resilient to natural hazards.
And what do you see as the barriers to responding to these challenges?
There's a number of barriers. I think conflicting demands would be certainly one of those barriers. So we have to, in the infrastructure space, make provision for a growing population or changing population, changing their demands in terms of what they would like to see as a service from the infrastructure. We do have aging infrastructure, so as our infrastructure is getting older, it is becoming more vulnerable or more fragile to impact from natural disasters. And then lastly, we've got just a certain amount of money. And it's a big challenge making a decision of the little bit of money we have, what are we going to invest that on? And what's going to be the best return for our community?
And I'm curious to know, what tools or research is available or that you have looked into to help planners approach these challenges?
Right now, in New Zealand, and thanks to support from central government, there's been some significant focus on, number one, understanding the hazards. So the one topic area that perhaps New Zealand is leading the world on is our ability to do a risk assessment of the natural hazards that we are facing. So that's an area that we've done a lot of work on, and we've got a good knowledge base. The area that we are struggling with still is a little bit in the decision-making area, and again, that's mostly around finance and budget. So there's different things that you can do for something that's at risk. You can either remove it, build it somewhere else. You can improve it from an engineering perspective. You can accept the risk, of course, and then you can transfer the risk to insurance. Now, there's some very big decisions in terms of having to decide how much to invest in a very uncertain future. So, yeah, it is a challenging research area, but we are making some progress in that area. Then there's the area of physical, let's call it engineering responses, so using better resilient materials, improving our design aspects, and that more physical engineering aspects we are also working on as fast as we can.
Are there any tools, I know you have commented on AI, for example, that should maybe be avoided or at least used more carefully?
Yes, absolutely. I think that AI brings a huge opportunity to the technical community. There are some things that we got to remember and a bit of caution when we're using AI. For example, most of AI is based on existing knowledge or past knowledge. And as I said before, obviously there's a huge shift in terms of the things we have to provide for in the future and the things that we faced in the past. So that's one of the cautionary aspects. And then also remember that more out-of-the-box and innovative thinking comes still from the human mind. So we need to, I guess, form a very strong and sensible partnership between the AI technology and what we have as human understanding.
And is there anything else you would want to speak to in terms of infrastructure challenges and responses?
Yes, I think just having constructive debates, because in the end, there's the technical and science community that's trying their best to communicate sometimes very complex aspects to the community. But at the end of the day, we want to also make decisions that's the best for our community's interest. So there's got to be a constructive dialogue and debate between the two parties, and that's always something that I encourage for people to learn more about some of these risks and what we can do about it. And then secondly, advice on what's really important, what matters most to our communities.
That was Associate Professor Tiens Henning of the University of Auckland's Faculty of Engineering on the challenges for New Zealand's infrastructure in the face of increasing extreme weather events.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts on any of these interviews, 5395. And this is some LCD sound system.
Make it
Sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
Following severe flooding in Wellington, concerns are growing over the discharge of untreated sewage into coastal waters and what that could mean for the marine ecosystems. Experts say the impacts could extend beyond immediate pollution, affecting habitats and species over time. I spoke with Dr. Christopher Cornwall, Senior Lecturer in Marine Biology at Victoria University of Auckland, about the environmental risks.
Following the recent flooding in Wellington, we've seen ongoing discharge of untreated sewage into coastal waters. At a broad level, how serious is that from an environmental perspective?
The ongoing sewage spill is concerning even without the short pipe. With the long pipe, it still has untreated sewage coming out of it continuously, just further from the coast. Both of those pipes go very close, if not onto Rocky Reef ecosystems. So we have kelp forests there that provide food and habitat for things like parwa, finfish, etc. We know from overseas work and also some work done here in Wellington, it's not published yet, that when we have sewage spills like that where dumping of sewage, then it can degrade those kelp forest systems. The extent to which is determined by the volume of sewage and how long that outflow is going to continue to occur without treatment of the sewage.
And you've mentioned that this kind of discharge can seriously impact marine ecosystems like kelp forests. What does that actually look like in practice?
So it can range from anything from what I would classify as subtle effects into larger, really obvious effects. So I'll go through both potential scenarios. So around Tarakina Bay, which is where sewage is coming directly out in the short pipe, what you'd expect there is there'll be larger impacts. And so the smaller impacts for the entire coastline, if we put untreated sewage out there, can be things like increased anthropogenic nitrogen, so nitrogen derived from that sewage. That can be used by different species of seaweeds and also microalgae that we might not want in the system, so it can shift the balance in that ecosystem. What we're looking at there is probably only small changes in things like green tide forming ulva. So before the plant was upgraded back in the 90s, the Moa Point area was well known for having lots of this ulva. And we know from overseas work that when we increase nitrogen, we can increase the ulva numbers. That might only be 5-10% across the whole coast and more around the Tarakina Bay and Moa Point area. But it could also locally form big blooms, and it has done that overseas, where it grows over everything. That's a more extreme event. What we could also see locally, particularly in Tarakina Bay, would be smothering of organisms. So think about invertebrates that essentially need to breathe, for want of a better word, underwater. We smother their gills, they can't breathe. Think about the seaweeds, we smother the seaweeds, they can no longer photosynthesize. So we're looking at mortality events. How much has occurred already? Unsure. Certainly, the wider area around the south coast hasn't had these big mortality events, but it's possible that around Tarakina Bay, particularly right where the sewage is coming out, there can be mortality of things like juvenile kelp, parwa, quite sensitive as well, anything that filter feeds. And other effects that are definitely going to happen would be changes in microbes. And so this could be ranging from very small changes in microbes, like increased human-derived bacteria, which Lala has picked up on in their readings, through to changes in what we call the microbiome of the organism. So think about yourself. Inside your gut, you have your gut microbiome that everyone knows about, and we know that we need to keep a healthy gut microbiome to stay healthy. The same for seaweeds in terms of the microbiome and their blades. The same for the internal microbiome and sponges, etc. So we change the microbiome, it has negative impacts and can also can stunt their growth and basically stress out these marine organisms. That's mostly what we would expect to see. We would expect to see local seaweeds taking up much more of this sewage-derived nitrogen. Things like reduced oxygen can also impact marine invertebrates and fish species. So that's what we would expect locally.
Yep, so you've mentioned things like nitrogen, microplastics, other contaminants like that entering the water. What effect do those have on marine life?
Yeah, actually, microplastics are an interesting one. So at the moment, I understand that they're not filtered out. So we're getting plastics into that water, other contaminants into the water that wouldn't usually go in there. Microplastics, for example, can go into organisms like sponges, filter feeders, and really start to alter their physiology, have release compounds, etc., that can stress them out, basically. When you're thinking about bigger plastics, they can have impacts on species that eat larger particles as well, and essentially have effects where they can fill up things like, we know that in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, for example, the amount of plastics out in the water there fills up seabirds. I'm not saying that's going to happen here in Wellington, but these are like more extreme events that could happen if there's too much plastic in the system. But in terms of microplastics, that's the most likely thing that's happening. It's difficult to measure. No one's really measured the microplastic levels in organisms around the coast beforehand, or at least in a systematic quantitative way. So we would expect there would be increases around that Tarakina Bay region there.
Is there a risk that this starts affecting food sources or local fisheries?
I certainly wouldn't be eating any of the kai species, and certainly would be thinking for a long time after this is fixed, which hopefully occurs very soon, that I wouldn't be eating it for a long time afterwards. So certainly there will be impacts on human health if we eat, particularly things like filter feeders that essentially could eat the sewage. So we don't really want to be doing that. We know that, I'm not an expert on human health, but we know that if we eat polluted organisms that it can have negative impacts on our health.
More broadly, does this event highlight bigger issues around how our infrastructure is set up to handle heavy rainfall?
It just, I think it highlights the fact that things haven't been managed properly. A member of the public emailed me saying that they've identified 5,000 instances of what they classified as illegal dumping occurring, and I'm not sure whether the numbers are correct. I'd have to look into that, but certainly there hasn't been great management of our waterways. I think collectively we need to think about managing systems on a reef by reef scale. We also know that there's sewage outflows into things like the Karori Stream. There's issues with, for example, the amount of sediments coming out of the Hutt River. During the flooding event, I would say the Hutt River would have a very large impact, probably more so than the sewage outflow on that south coast. So a big ground line coming out of the Hutt River, coming out into the harbour, and then therefore onto the south coast. So these kind of events, it's unknown how much sediment will be coming out of that Hutt River pre-European times, but we've certainly impacted these systems, and we're not really thinking about it. We don't have a connected system to manage reefs at a reef-by-reef scale, and certainly setting up sewage outflows to go out onto temperate kelp forests that are sensitive to sewage is not a great management strategy, in my opinion.
And finally, what should people be paying attention to over the next few weeks or months as the situation develops?
I would just be real hesitant about collecting those kai species, like you said. I would hope that someone in the medical profession could speak more on this and in more detail. I currently haven't seen any media coverage from a human health expert on the South Coast spill in terms of what activities we can and cannot do. And I believe that we need greater monitoring of these types of events across Aotearoa. We need greater management. What can people do? They can keep an eye out and pressure for this to be fixed. They can also vote for policies that enact greater management of our, or better management of our marine systems in general. Those are the things that I would be thinking that people could do on an individual level.
That was Dr. Christopher Cornwall about the environmental impacts of the sewage discharge following flooding in Wellington.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Dā Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, University of Auckland's Tiens Henning, Victoria University's Christopher Cornwall, and the University of Auckland's Tim Hazeldine. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Sophia.
Cracks and
supports the ego, it's called love. And it's so uncool, it's called love. And somehow it's become unmentionable.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.